Off Message is brought to you this week by The Great Courses Plus, engaging video lectures presented by top university professors on a variety of topics. It's the perfect way to learn for the pure pleasure of it. With The Great Courses Plus, you'll have unlimited access to a wealth of knowledge, watch lectures from any device on your own schedule, and sign up today to get your first month free. Go to thegreatcoursesplus.com/offmessage. Hey, everybody, it's Glenn Thrush with Politico's Off Message podcast, my pre-vacation episode. It's interesting interviewing newsmakers on the podcast. It was something I never did before, and it was really before the last year, year and a half. In fact, my entire reporting philosophy was predicated on not talking to newsmakers. And by newsmakers, I mean, in Washington, we also call them principals. So the president is a principal, or a or a senator, or the target of the story that you're writing. And, you know, I kind of was raised in an environment of investigative reporting, but also very much steeped in the philosophy. And this is really kind of a function of me being raised in New York City and raised in kind of the New York City tabloid environment of working from the outside in. So you talked with people who were kind of peripheral to the story, and then gradually you worked your way in towards the subject. And really the only way that you get somebody who is at the center of the story is by forcing them to talk to you, often off the record, by the way, by presenting them with information they have to respond to. So my goal as a reporter for really the first 15 years of my career was to dig up enough information that the person at the center of my story, whether it be one of the stories I did as a younger reporter was about Dr. Zorro, a gynecologist who carved a Z in a patient's stomach. I tracked this guy down to Florida. He was living with his 95-year-old father in Fort Lauderdale. Nobody had gotten him. And I had done that really by just talking to a concentric circle of his patients and friends and stuff. So eventually I got to him. But I never really did it the other way around, which is very much the Washington way of, like, you know, negotiating with people over how to get them on the podcast and just getting those folks up front. It's been very jarring for me. And one of the reasons I did the podcast, apart from just trying to stay sane in 2016, I had never really just sort of sat across from newsmakers and interviewed them. And I really wanted to see if I could do it. And moreover, I wanted to learn how to do it. It's a very interesting contrast. And I think you do lose something when you go straight for the person that you want to talk to. And I think one of those things that you kind of lose is a sense of kind of filling in the blanks before you talk to them, trusting them to tell you the story. And a lot of my time is spent arguing, persuading, talking with people so that they could come on the podcast. That's really a total difference in anything I'd ever done before. And I kind of hate it, which is trying to convince people to come on. But it goes with the territory. And oftentimes it pays off big time, because here's the thing that we've learned, Bridget and I, from doing this now for going on, I guess, 8 months. And that is, the person we talk to never complains about being asked intrusive questions. It is always the staff and their handlers who are mostly concerned about that stuff. Once we get the person in the seat, they're usually capable of handling themselves. And that's been a real lesson for me. Well, anyway, here's a guy who really knows how to do what I'm just learning how to do, John Dickerson, who I think is a terrific interviewer. It's part of his family business. His mother, Nancy Dickerson, was one of the first women correspondents in Washington. She interviewed presidents. He's really known for this technique he has, and it's really, it first started with George W. Bush when he was covering the White House, asking really open-ended questions and getting subjects to either hang themselves or explain themselves, often both at the same time. And the usual business, please follow us on iTunes and rate us, and send me your emails, I love them, at gthrush@politico.com. Without any further ado, here is John Dickerson. So let's talk about your guitar. You got a Washburn acoustic sitting in the corner of your office here. Tell me a little bit. You mentioned that you started playing in high school. Were you ever I know you're a friend of Jay Carney's. Were you a Guided by Voices guy too?
No. I was a more of a Bob Dylan kind of folk music, classic rock kind of guy. I never caught. I mean, Jay is obsessed.
Yeah, he's really, really obsessed.
Yeah. When we worked together, he would always disappear on various weekends to go travel pretty far to go see Guided by Voices.
I got to tell you, when it's on the radio, it doesn't always stay on my radio.
Yeah.
What's your favorite Dylan record?
I go through different phases. What phase am I in now?
Changing.
I think we all are. I always kind of hover back to sort of around the 1974 period. I don't know. Let me think. What am I? Desire? The Desire period, the Rolling Thunder Review period, the reuniting with Joan Baez, the a couple of years ago released the outtakes from, I guess, was it the 74 practice sessions? Mm-hmm. I'm kind of in that period a little bit. I just saw him at Wolf Trap when he was out there. And, it's a different kind of experience than the first time I saw him in 1986.
It's getting a little hoary.
Yeah. You know, the thing of it is, though, I wish somebody would just say, Bob, you know, let the microphone do its work.
Yes.
And stop yelling in the microphone because it's not helping anybody.
I don't think people have really been able to tell him anything for a period. I love Blood on the Tracks. But I really love Desire. I mean, Desire, I really came to Desire very, very late. I'm a band guy, so I actually came to Dylan backwards. I came to him through the Basement Tapes.
Oh, that's good. Well, that's a fine way to do it.
So you are, we should just say, and I'm really thankful for this, you are out on your feet. Tell me, what have you been doing for the last 15, 16 days?
Yeah, Dickerson? So we had to, two conventions, and then I was smart enough to start a book tour the Monday morning right after we did the show on Sunday. So finished the show on Sunday. Caught up with my family who we hadn't all been in the same place for 6 weeks.
Right.
Saw them for a few hours and went to New York and started the book tour.
Wow. And so this is, are you going to, any way that you can ramp down, you go on vacation or something?
No, we go to the show Sunday, then I leave for LA and San Francisco to do book tour events there. The family will go and disappear again back into their summer plans, and then I'll come back and work. I think I'm going to try and take a few days off at the end of August.
This sounds really physically not fun.
It's been stretching, but I think the good thing is, one, my kids have a great summer plan full of like camps and doing kids with things that kids are supposed to do, and getting away from your parents, I think, is a great thing for kids to have, go and have their own experiences and then come back and tell you about them, and that commerce is really great. And the letters I exchanged with my daughter in particular this summer.
Letters, not emails?
Letters from her to me, emails from me to her. Very because cool. The camp prints them out and gives them to her. But I wouldn't have traded those for anything. Those were fantastic, the letters that we exchanged. And so they're fine. I don't, and then my wife has been catching up with me at various places on the road, so that's been all right. But it was a crazy thing to put out a book in a campaign year, but when it's a book about presidential campaigns, you got to do it. Yeah, exactly.
In terms of the, it is the 10th anniversary. I heard you talk with Axelrod on that excellent podcast you did with him about your mom, and it is the 10th, it's basically the 10th anniversary of the publication of that book about your mother, right?
Right, right.
I think from a Freudian perspective, very good idea to get that out of the way before you start writing other books.
Yes, well, there was clearly much to wrestle with. But it's amazing, that was 10 years ago. Golly. Yeah, so 10 years, and about 20 years since she died.
So that was you've talked about this a bit, but I just want to spend a couple of minutes on it because I think it's fascinating, and you were really candid in the way that you talked about it. How did you wind up, because one of the things that struck me about it, I didn't read the entire book, I read bits of it when it came out, and I read the reviews again recently, which had some excerpts in it. One of the things that I find really striking is one of the issues that you had, and for those of you out there who don't know, I guess we should talk about some of the basics. Your mom, tell everybody who your mom was.
Sure. I think she's over my shoulder there in front of the Capitol. There's a picture of her when She has a New York Times and a Washington Post in her hand. So she was a reporter. Well, she came to Washington. She worked on the Foreign Relations Committee. She was on The Hill. Then she was a producer for CBS for about 8 years before she always wanted to be on TV. And then in 1960, they allowed her to be on TV after 8 years of trying. And she was the first woman news correspondent for CBS. And then the first woman to report from a political convention, the floor of a convention in 1960. And then she went in 1963 to NBC and was with NBC for about 10 years and then left NBC or NBC helped her leave. They didn't renew her contract, but a very different kind of career after that. You know, she was a kind of a star and during the 60s and early 70s and then had a kind of slightly quieter career after that.
So there's a show, I mean, there is a, and you know, this duality, and this is your duality, right? I mean, you are a wonderful fluid writer who really, I mean, you really have that as a capacity, which a lot of TV folks don't have. But you also have, obviously, the component with TV. But she was really in a system where she was treated as a star. Like there was a component, and stars tend to fade.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an excruciating experience. And you, as a kid, had to deal with that end of it as well, right?
Right. And that's very perceptive. That's exactly right. And she dealt with stardom, or was a star, in a way that was so different because she was the first woman. So she was a star, and it was really stardom. I mean, it was really the first person of that kind. And that gets incredibly alluring, and all the friends you suddenly have. And she writes about this in her book about, you know, the kind of casual chumminess, mm-hmm. people who don't know each other, but who are sort of stars or stars. And
right.
so suddenly, you know, Johnny Carson is talking to you as if you've known him since you were
right.
a kid. And that's so alluring. And then when that goes away,
it's also dislocated. It's also, I mean, it creates a certain dissonance too, because it's not, and this is something, again, this is something I found very interesting in the way that you framed all this stuff, is it's phony.
Yeah. 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 Oh,
these
right.
These are not necessarily.
Yeah.
These are not real relationships, right?
No, they're
but,
not.
But you mourn for their loss nonetheless, right?
Yeah. You mourn for the, basically the easy way in which life proceeds before you. I mean, you get the best seats at the restaurants, you get the plane held for you, you get people going out of their way to do things for you, and you get just the general bath of adulation that, now, it should be said that there were years, and even there's a downside to that. I mean, the criticism that people had of women, and particularly somebody who was quite attractive, you know, there was a lot of people who thought, oh, well, you're only in the job because you're
right.
attractive, and internally as well as externally. So it wasn't all, blossoms. But anyway, when that disappears, then you have the worst of both worlds, because you're no longer the big star, and you feel somewhere in the back of your mind like, it's an affirmation of the criticisms of you because, you know, your contract wasn't renewed, or
right.
they're not, you weren't picked to be the new host of the Today Show, or you're not getting on the evening news, because people don't think you're substantively any good. And that's a double whammy.
But that's an interesting question as well, right? That was a more substantive age. If you look at the old, tapes, right? The level of discourse was far more, I mean, it was no golden age, right? But the level of discourse was much more in the weeds in terms of policy. The granularity of these discussions was just so much more substantial than they were.
Right, and people participated in discussions. I mean, both they were available for interviews. I mean, some weren't, but they were available. You could talk to them.
Right.
And when you talked to them, they weren't encased in prepackaged talking points in the way that they are now. And they also, so there are two kinds of talking points, the ones where they say nothing, and then the ones where they just attack their opponents. So the conversations were a lot more real.
Well, what's interesting also is like what you became initially known for when you started in the business, and it is something I attempt to do and don't do necessarily successfully all the time, is to ask the seemingly vanilla, open-ended question that allows that people are not on guard for, that presents them with an opportunity to, I wouldn't say hang themselves, that's pejorative, but to reveal things that they otherwise wouldn't reveal.
Right. I mean, I think there are many different ways to do interviews and ask questions. And not every, well, first of all, the sort of prosecute. There's a view of question asking where it's it's sort of Perry Mason-y, right. prosecutorial. You know, where were you?
Sam Donaldson would be, I think.
Yeah, Sam Donaldson with the expectation that you're under oath, right? And that, but a lot of that is kind of show, and it doesn't get you anywhere. And so I think just allowing any politician to think out loud is great, you know, and because that gives you some window into what they believe and who they are. Right. And they all, many of them, spend a lot of time practicing how not to do that,
right.
Which is a shame because, I mean...
In my experience, they tend, and there are as many exceptions as there are rules to this, but they tend generally to be interesting people when you get them in real conversation.
Sure. Yeah, they've had interesting experiences. Yeah. They've come from places that have shaped them, and they come from physical places we don't always get in touch with or have experience with. And they've obviously had enough drive and focus and sense of mission to get them where they are. So yeah, they're interesting people. They have interesting views on things. And and more broadly, we should find ways to
yes.
unbind them from their... from the things that constrain them from saying what's either on their mind or what they actually believe, so we might actually make a little progress.
As Dr. Freud would say, back to your mother. But one of the things I just want to pick up on a strand that we kind of left unexplored, which is she was a substantial person.
Yeah.
There's actually a great picture of her where she's going through what looks like reams and reams of like research material, right? Did you learn, because you're a substantial person, was she a reader? Did you learn any of that side of that from her?
You know, I'm trying to see if there are any of her books on the bookshelves here. All my books are really at home, but she has, you know, I have a lot of her old books, and so her underlining is in the books, and so I saw that she read them, and there's actually a notebook over there that's the notes she wrote for, or the questions she wrote for an interview she did with President Nixon. It was an interview in which the anchors from all the major networks and then PBS were invited to sit down with Nixon at the same time.
Oh, my God.
And I think there are, you know, I don't know, 90-some-odd questions in there. I think she only probably got to ask about six because, you know, once you milk six by four different anchors, it gets to a lot of questions. But, she worked really, really hard. So she read a lot, not because necessarily she was an intellectual, but because she knew that, you know, that was the work that was required for the job.
Look, I love Schieffer. I think Schieffer is a terrific, he once gave a speech before an award that I won, and I really just, you cannot follow. I found following him to be very, very difficult. But the main thing, and it seems to be the common thread between you two, is civility and wanting to elevate discourse, which really seems to be going completely out the window these days.
A lot of that kind of I got from an early age. I think also for me, it's just there is so motive questioning, snap judgments, and all that just gets me nowhere. And so I think people don't want that either.
So when you say it gets you nowhere, is that a trial and error thing?
Did I try that and it didn't work? Yeah. What I meant, I think, is interpersonally, when I was a kid, so we grew up in a hugely judgmental family about all things and all people. and I don't find that a very good way to live one's life. I don't think it...
put a finer point on that. What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, you know, when somebody says something, instead of thinking, I wonder if that's right. Does that make sense to me? And if it doesn't make sense to me, why are they saying that? And what is it about what they're saying that tells me something about either the issue we're talking about or where they come from? That's a better way, it seems to me, to responding than they're dumb.
Oh, judgment versus totally deliberation.
Wrong. Yeah, precisely. And right, I think, right. And judgment just is, I don't think it tells you anything. It doesn't open up your mind. It negates the humanity of the other person you're talking to. And that took me a little, through college, kind of right into the real world was when I started trying to shed some of that, because you realize the more people you spend time with, and this is particularly true, as you know, when you go out and talk to voters, you know, we hear like the noisiest, most the hottest voices control the debate. You talk to regular people, they're regular people.
And even the loudest voices when you should, like I had Roger Stone on this thing, right? And Roger Stone, it's one of my favorite moments of ever doing. It's one of the reasons I love doing this. Roger Stone was talking reasonably and like explaining strategy, what it was like to work with Trump. And then he goes off on a completely nutty tangent about Hillary Clinton. And I said, shut the F up. And he was like, okay. And he snapped back into the rationality. I mean, you get rationality if you're looking for rationality.
Yeah.
And you get the stupid ass soundbite if you're looking for the stupid ass soundbite.
I think that's true. But then I also think that people are basically, I don't know, maybe it's because so much of our conversation is ruined by social media, by which I mean it accentuates the hottest voices and the least temperate and the most motive questioning voices and not the deliberative ones. And then when you go out into the country and you talk to people and they think, well, I'm voting for this person, but I understand this and that and the other thing about them or right. about the opponent. And they have complex things in their lives and they're basically kind of in the messy middle. And that's kind of the way I think about covering the news, which is that, you know, you can reason your way to the right place, but it doesn't mean that the other person who has a different view is evil.
Right.
And just, you know.
By the way, which is an absolutely elegant transition to this year. You've interviewed Donald Trump how many times?
I think 19. We're at 19 now.
I'm at zero. he doesn't talk to our organization. Tell me, I'm just going to ask you sort of this bluntly, because I've wrestled with this myself. I have called him recently a liar on Twitter because I think someone who lies habitually is a liar. Look, I know this is a difficult question to ask. You can tell me to jump in a lake. Do you think, having interviewed him these 19 times, that the man is a liar?
Well, it depends what you mean by that word, right? Because that word gets thrown around a lot, right, in what we in politics, and sometimes it can mean willful you know, misstatements. It can mean statements where you just choose your set of facts, which is basically what politics is. And other times it can mean you conveniently lied, you know, they're lies of omission. I think he wants to believe what he wants to believe. And I think he's reluctant to back down, even if he knows there's a difference between what he believes. I mean, I you know, does he intentionally say things he knows not to be true? With this Iranian, the $400 million that the U.S. gave to Iran, I think it was three rallies in which he said there was a video. Did he know that what he was saying was not true? I don't know. I think he ought to know what's in his actual heart. I think what I would love is a word for the recklessness he shows for the truth, which is, and he's not the only one. Hillary Clinton, when she talks about her email server, is being reckless as well.
Right.
So, but I'm not trying. I'm not being equivalent there.
You do
I'm
hazard,
not being
yeah,
equivalent
you do
there.
Yeah.
That, yeah. I hasten to, but I guess because I think he does it. He is more reckless with. I mean, I think they're, you know.
But you see, as a part of the woven into the fabric of his mentality, as opposed to any individual decision that he's making.
Yeah, yeah. I think he
doesn't that, but doesn't that let him? Okay, just
well, I don't know. Yeah. No, I don't. I think
because we have agency, and you and I, as we're talking right now, we're making individual decisions in real time about what's true and what's not. Right.
Right.
Does that speak to a larger incapacity to view individual exchange as an individual exchange?
Yeah. Well, I think he could. I think you could imagine that as all of us, you know, if you're rushing to make a point, and somebody picks, let's step outside of Donald Trump for a second. Somebody picks at something you say, and you say that doesn't matter. My larger point is X.
Right.
Okay, they may have been right about the interim little thing, but you've got a larger point.
Right.
I think he is. That's his view on basically everything. Just like, and now the larger point may not be some, but it may not be a larger truth. The larger point for him may be whatever point he's trying to get across, and he'll use, you know, he'll assemble whatever he needs to get there. And if you disagree with the pieces that got you there, he doesn't think that's a lie. He thinks you're just being picky. He would like, I mean, I think he would like it to be true that he was right about Iraq, but it's not.
I would like it to be true that I have hair.
Yeah. But I think also when you measure, also let's think of it another way, which is on Iraq, you know, Barack Obama did have the speech that he gave at the time. It was unpopular to say it, where he said, I'm not against all wars, I'm against stupid wars.
Absolutely.
And so if that should be, that's another way to look at this, which is, okay, let's not adjudicate, let's not have a debate about how many times you said you were for, thought the war was a good idea, and how many times you said it was a bad idea. Measuring against people who really have taken stands against the tide of the times, and you know, score him on a score of 1 to 10,
right.
You know, he was a like a 2 maybe, if that, because he in fact was for the war first before he was against it. So I think that I'm just in favor of a kind of more thorough investigation, but I'm not debating the premise, which is that he says a lot of things that are verifiably not so.
Well, you are at the tip of the spear on this sort of thing. And let me ask you, starting this cycle, you had an expectation this was going to be a relatively normal presidential cycle, as we all did. How has your role, the way that you view it, and you kind of jumped in the saddle right as this thing was going, starting up. How do you think Trump has changed the way that you view the way that you're doing your job right now? Have you had to reassess anything fundamental?
Well, I think one of the things that I worry about is that when we do some of this fact checking, that if, before Donald Trump started talking about people celebrating on 9/11, 5% of the country thought that might have been the case. After he talks about it and it's fact checked like crazy and nobody can find the footage, and there's no evidence of it.
We're talking about dancing on the rooftops in New Jersey.
In New Jersey and nobody can find evidence that suggests that it was as widespread as he originally described it. I bet now if you did that same poll, you'd find 30 people who believe that it happened. Because when you fact check, there is some number of people who don't hear the fact check. They hear the first assertion and think, oh, there might be something to it.
That is incredibly interesting. So paying any attention to it. So to some extent, Trump's theory of the case, which is any publicity is good publicity, which is being sorely tested at this moment,
yeah.
Right? Is actually true in terms of like how people perceive
stuff.
Well,
here's another thing, is the video of the supposed $400 million yeah. ransom. So Trump asserted in 3 different instances that there was such video. He then corrected himself. I bet there are more people now who think there's actual video.
Well, this is big lie kind of thing, right? Yeah. So,
now I'm not, whether he's doing that intentionally or not is up for debate. But I guess my point is,
yeah,
we rush in and do the fact check as we should. It's about the basic, most
right.
basic thing we're supposed to do. But there is a cost to it, and it does have a cost.
That's interesting.
Because you can then imagine a politician, let's say you and I have 5 things to discuss.
Yeah.
I'm going to say the first thing that is outrageous and that I know might not really be true, and
right.
we'll get in a big, you know, wind down a rabbit hole, and you don't get to ask your other 4 questions. And more people at the end of our conversation will think the underlying thing that I said that you've been fact-checking me about for 6 minutes. So I think we have to be really aware of that.
And so what does that mean? What does that mean? You sort of do your initial fact-checking on that and then pull the hell back? Like, you don't keep harping that point to lose the repetition?
Also, a second thing I would say is, you know what people don't actually like in practice, which they say they want, is when you ask the same question 6 times. Now, the people who really dislike a politician,
right.
they like it when you ask the same question 6 times. But the people who I'm trying to help here with what we do, which is the people who have an open mind, the people who are trying to learn something, both about the positions of the politician, but about the context in which the debate is taking place.
Yeah.
Those are the people who say, gosh, why are you doing this 6 straight times?
Even though it's part of a process that is at times essential. When,
sure. Sometimes, yeah. I mean, there are, you know, when I interviewed and talked to Mr. Trump about the judge overseeing the Trump University case.
Were he really got tangled in his own shoelaces in that answer?
Well, you know, but I thought that was important because it told us something about his thinking. It told us something about the way he views what is a kind of a Central American tenet, which is that you're not defined by who your parents are.
Right. And not Central American, Central American.
Yeah. Exactly.
Could be Central American.
You know, so I asked him, I don't know, I think it was 6 times about what the judge's heritage had to do with his ability to rule, because I thought that was something that was illuminating about on big stuff.
Right.
And this is, we're having a debate about what it means to be an American, what America is. It wasn't some small side issue. And also it was something about, you know, about the character of the candidate. So on some things you want to spend some time, but on one of the challenges to all of us is that on any politician you're talking to, you know, you could follow up on a bunch of different things they say, but that doesn't allow you the time to then go at stuff you think is more important.
So was there did people call up and say, I wish you wouldn't have asked them that 9 different times?
I don't know. I don't think so. I mean, I've, they did in another instance where I asked him what the Corey Lewandowski's incident with the reporter. I saw it as a management issue, which is to say that Donald Trump runs an organization. Here, an employee of his said something didn't happen. There was video footage that showed that it did. So, how do you? What does that tell us about him as a manager? I try as best I can to ask questions that lead to trying to tell us something about what these people would be like in the Oval Office. So with Hillary Clinton and the server, my view is, what do people know about when you're going to be alone and nobody's watching about how truthful you'll be? Like, and with him, I felt it was a management question. A lot of viewers thought it was, you know, it was too much questioning about this thing.
In terms of judgment, because one of the big questions here is the equivalence of the email versus some of these other things that Trump is involved. In terms of the constellation of not the constellation, but kind of the balancing of these equities. How big do you think the email server is and her answers are in comparison to this larger oeuvre of Trump's misstatements?
Well, she was in an official position, and that's a big deal. Official statements and official acts are more important than just stuff that gets said in a campaign. So, and there are two questions at issue. One, what do you do when no one's looking? Which is what the setting up the server in the first place. There's a lot of times when nobody's looking when you're president. And also the culture you create around you for whether everybody is on the lookout to do the right thing, not because they're being watched, but because they want to try and do the right thing. That was the ethos that President Obama started the presidency with.
Right.
He has fallen short of that goal in terms of transparency and at certain times, certainly with things like relationships to lobbyists and things like that, and he would probably even admit some of that. But so it goes to, what do you do when no one's looking? And then what do you do when they are looking? And do you say, you know, that was a dumb idea and I shouldn't have done it because it was a bad idea in the first place? It thwarted efforts to keep records that are important for the public record and so that we can be checked by a free and open press. It wasn't good because it might have been hacked by foreign nationals and for the other things that were. And so that getting to that, and that's really actually never been really said. I mean, she said it was a mistake to do it once it got discovered, but not that it was wrong for all of the underlying reasons that it was wrong.
Do you think she believes?
I don't quite think so.
No, I had 45 minutes with her. My sense is that I don't think she thinks she did. She thinks she was justified because Colin Powell did it, and I think she thought the State Department server was compromised, and I also think she's got this zone of privacy argument that she has in her head since 92, right?
Right. Well, I mean, I think, and you know, that's what's interesting to me about that is that's her blind spot. She's among her blind spots. We all have blind spots, but you know, she's been in the public eye and been attacked by her opponents for a long time, and wants to find some way to wall off some part of her life from that, from those prying eyes.
That is an interesting, it is, what's so interesting about that is, well, Trump is able to achieve that in large measure because he's in the private sector and he has the cash to be able to insulate himself, right? That seems to be fraying right now. Right?
Well, but also we should note, I mean, I think you could probably, and I'm just coming to this, but I mean, Donald Trump's instinct to hide his tax returns, which is a norm of politics since Nixon, that you hand over your tax returns. I mean, he doesn't want people looking at them because he doesn't want people to look into his personal stuff,
right?
And he thinks it'll undermine his campaign. That's exactly what Hillary Clinton did with the server. Now, the problem is he's not Secretary of State. He's a politician, and people can decide whether they think he's being on the level or not by hiding his tax returns. Hillary Clinton was obligated to follow certain kinds of rules because she was an employee of the federal government. So, you know, there's obviously a distinction there.
So that's interesting, though. His secrecy on that.
That's
a parallel. You see that as an equivalent.
I think it comes from the same motivation, which is his might be even more politically motivated. Although I'm sure hers was.
Well, he's told it to George.
Right. I mean, good politicians are good at fooling us.
Right.
By showing. I mean, and that's why Reagan, when he said, you know, being president is just like another role. Now you can go too far because. You know, that you can be performing, but also be authentic, or the sentiments that you're adding a little performance to can come from a place of authenticity. But we judge a lot of stuff as authentic that is actually artifice. And so when a candidate can't manufacture that artifice in a way that's pleasing to us,
right.
it's nevertheless labeled as inauthenticity, which is obviously, you know, the analysis eats itself. So
like having a beer with somebody who hasn't had a drink in 30 years.
Right, exactly.
Right.
Or who doesn't like beer at all.
Right.
Yeah, So I think that that's another. Also, you can just basically overemphasize the benefit of you know, quote unquote, authenticity. I think that you know, one of the things that Ezra Klein has a piece about Hillary Clinton in which he emphasizes and spends some time talking about the amount of listening she does and arguing pretty persuasively about the benefits of the listening skill.
He is so right
yeah.
about that. I think he is incredibly
and about that. The only thing yeah. I was, and I, and the only thing I haven't quite figured out is, so anyway, the, just to finish off the
yeah,
argument is that she has the listening skill, which it doesn't ever, there's no real way in which that translates in politics where we suddenly said, boy, I went to a great speech and the candidate really listened well. That doesn't, it's a hard, I can't think of a great moment where somebody listened excessively well. I mean, maybe in a town hall, certainly Clinton in that town hall debate in 1992, when he asked the voter who had asked George Herbert Walker Bush the question about the debt
yep.
And deficit, you know, Clinton had listened enough to then query and make a connection with the voter. So that's a little bit of that. But basically, we lift up people who can give great stem-winding speeches, which is not one of her talents. What I'm interested in terms of that listening skill, which I think is crucial and I think is a great insight of Ezra's, is if you are a great listener, and his argument is listening leads to consensus building to then trying to make workable solutions, and that's better. But I think there's also a way in which if you're a great listener, you then listen, take in, and then replay people to themselves. So you become...
But that's a political skill.
Yes. And that's why I'm wondering why that doesn't exist.
Because it just doesn't.
Yeah. But you could. But if you've got the listening part, you could just convey it back to them.
Hey guys, sorry to interrupt. Just a quick break. This political season, you've heard all the speeches. You've seen all the news. Now we want you to learn the history behind it all. And here's the way. Sign up for the Great Courses Plus. You'll get unlimited access to engaging video lectures on history, politics, economics, and so many more subjects that'll explain how we got to this moment in time. Presented by award-winning professors and experts. Sign up for the Great Courses Plus now, and you'll get a free month of unlimited access to all the courses, including The Skeptic's Guide to American History. Start your free month now by going to thegreatcoursesplus.com/offmessage. Remember, thegreatcoursesplus.com/offmessage. And now back to John Dickerson. Okay, back to your mother. Sorry. You don't think gender, come on, man.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. No, I think
a lot of this
sure.
has to do with the fact that everyone, and she is shouty. You know, I never took more shit in my life than when I tweeted, she was giving some speech and I was like, stop shouting. She was shouting, okay? And it was driving everybody crazy. Women, men, whatever. But there is a sense, I do think the listening thing, and I know from people who ran the 2000 campaign for her, that the listening tour is about that.
Yeah. Oh,
it's
yeah.
It's about creating a milieu in which a strong woman can be on the stage, but not in a threatening way.
Right. And also, by the way, it's incredibly compelling if it's done right. Because that's what politicians should be doing, is
yeah.
listening. Now, you can go overboard, of course. I mean, you have to lead at some point and stop listening. But it's a fine as a political act, but and also obviously as a part of being president. You want to be
but
able
okay,
to
so again, this might be a synthetic connection. But your mother was a pioneer at a time when people weren't doing this. This woman is a pioneer at the time. You talk about your mother's preparation because she had to compete.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see parallels?
Oh yeah, I mean the I think also Hillary Clinton gets actual joy from trying to figure out policy solutions to problems. I mean, you just see it time and time
yes.
again in her career, and doing the hard work of grinding small change that people don't see. So I think she genuinely thinks that's useful and brings her joy. I don't think it brings her like, you know, miles of giggles, but I think it brings her fulfillment and meaning in her life. So But I think also, so that, so it's hard to know whether she works hard because she thinks I'm a woman and I have to be twice as smart as all the guys, or she just works twice as hard because she wants to do the policy stuff that gives her joy.
Or if it's of a piece.
Yeah, yeah. Or if it's the same thing. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Or she ran to the path of least resistance so that, you know, if in a man's world, the men get to do the performing, you have to, you know, do the smart stuff behind the scenes to get your moment to perform. Maybe that's what it is. I don't know. That's, I mean, I'm making it up there.
But do you think, having had your experience, I mean, the first book you wrote was about your mom, right? Mm. Do you think, having had this experience and watching a sort of a gender pioneer, I mean, do you think gender has a lot to do with some of the things that are perceived as her flaws publicly?
Well, I think you're, yeah, I think you're right. I think it has to do with both what we expect from presidents. She's not, I mean, think about masculinity and the way in which it's talked about with presidency, you know, the wimp factor with George Herbert Walker Bush in 1988. You know, the way in which LBJ was obsessed with manhood and Kennedy
and Trump
also.
Trump and his fingers.
Trump, yes, and his fingers and the shirts at his rallies that says finally, you know, a president who has balls. And, you know, when James Carville wanted to criticize Obama, he said that, you know, Hillary Clinton had more balls than he did. This always gets back to that,
right.
You know? So we are obviously obsessed with that in American presidential you know, toughness and manliness is embedded in the way we look at our president. So of course it's got to be in there. And I think that's probably true. The criticisms of the performance criticisms that come from the fact that we don't have a template for a woman who gives great speeches. I mean, think about the great speeches in American history. How many of them, I mean, you basically got Eleanor Roosevelt. How many of them?
Ann Richards?
Yeah, sure. That was the other one
I thought Michelle Obama gave.
Oh yeah, no, I agree. But I'm saying those are new templates. I think Michelle Obama is creating new. I think we're now, you know, 100 years from now, the book with 100 great American speeches will have a lot more women in it. But it doesn't.
It is an interesting dynamic.
Yeah,
we have an expectation of, you know, of it being the funeral oration, right? Pericles. In terms of, just a couple more questions, but getting to this issue of 2016, obviously Trump has dominated everything. You go on our website, 7 of the top 10 stories on average over the past year and a half have the word Trump in them, right? Is this election, do you think, going to be remembered as the Donald Trump election, or is this election going to be remembered as the first woman major party nominee election? If you were to rise above
the, I think Donald Trump, because we've never, I mean, there are, you know, part of what my book is about is the parallels with times in the past, but he was such a surprise. He has uncovered something or created something in his party that it will be responding to. I think if Hillary Clinton is elected, she'll be remembered for the, you know, being the first woman president, and then this will be remembered, oddly, as the Trump election. I mean, I think there's a way in which history can handle both those things.
Can handle both those things.
Yeah. I think because...
Or maybe the year the Republican Party
came apart.
Came apart, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, or significantly shifted its... I mean, I'm not sure that I mean, if you look at the way, because of the way we talk about politics now, you know, anybody who has issues with Donald Trump, which are based on their sense of values and morals, you know, is being derided by some of the voices in the party as evil, as horrible, you know, not just turncoats, but just horrible people. And that's not that you can't sustain. I mean, when those kinds of things are said, you don't say, oh yeah, well, it's okay, fine, it's all fine in the end, because what's really they're character claims that are being made about other people, and those live on after the candidates go away.
So do you think, and your book is obviously about all these campaigns you've covered, do you think that Donald Trump, and I guess the question I pretty much in some form or another asked everybody, is Donald Trump a black swan? Or do you think he has altered this process forever, or at least for the foreseeable?
I feel like it could be both, because what he has the debate that's taking place in the Republican Party right now about whether it's Donald Trump who's created this situation where you have members who don't want to support their party nominee but are fearful of saying that because right. they don't want to lose the voters who support him, but they don't want to support him so much that they lose the moderates who used to be or are a part of the Republican coalition, this bind that they're in. What's the reason for that bind? Is it purely Donald Trump? Or is it that, you know, or do you believe what the authors of the autopsy wrote and what, say, John Kasich believes, which is that the party has to stop appealing to its more nativist elements, and that that's a problem with the party and its makeup. So I don't know.
Great candidates, my theory of the case, you know, if Donald Trump were a good candidate, we wouldn't be necessarily having this discussion.
He'd be able to elide the problems.
Great candidates. We are not a country with searingly ideological parties as a historical thing. They represent sort of broad coalitions, right? Candidates make parties successful.
I think that's a very appealing argument, because if you look at what Reagan did, there was a period in 76 where, William Rusher, editor or the publisher of the National Review, and others were trying to get him to leave the Republican Party and form the Conservative Party. And one of his genius moves was not leaving the Republican Party.
And there were incredibly bitter divisions between
incredibly bitter divisions, and not leaving the party, because he recognized if he created a Conservative Party in 1976, he would get basically blamed for, although certainly Gerry Ford blamed him for it anyway, but he would get blamed for basically splitting the vote right. and giving it to Carter. Now, Ford blamed him for challenging him anyway and then not helping him enough once he'd gotten the nomination. But still, what was genius about Reagan is he kept everybody in the damn tent. And that's to your point, which is that Donald Trump could excite. And actually, you could imagine this not being that hard, because he has excited the base. And obviously, the party, you know, Paul Ryan is going along with the base. So just don't attack him.
Look at he's got evangelicals. I mean, I just think it's like this. He's a cataclysmically unskilled candidate for a general election and a very good candidate in a primary, right?
Yeah.
Last question, and it's a doozy. Looking at the news business, I think we all got to kind of, a lot of mirrors are going to be set up, right? We're all going to be looking at ourselves like we don't like to do that anyway. But my question, and you know, you are a very diplomatic person, and I would appreciate a little less diplomacy on this answer. We have seen, I think, particularly in basic cable, who's our whole business is challenged economically. People are looking for business models on everything. How do you think, in terms of giving, for instance, when CNN shows the empty podium, Donald Trump's empty podium, or the plane fueling up at National, or the helicopter landing, tell me what you think as a words person, and as somebody who's thought a lot about this. Do you think, if you were to sort of go back and look at the way this was handled, do you think the media enabled Trump? Do you think this argument that $3 billion of earned media, I mean, what adjustments do you think need to be made?
Well, I would say that I'm skeptical about the free media. I mean, it obviously helped him, but it could have hurt him just as much as it helped him. I mean, there are plenty, you know, other politicians don't do as much press because they're terrified they're going to do something to hurt themselves.
Right.
So if they did as much press, then go compete with him on that field and maybe beat him. But they weren't doing the same thing. They weren't making themselves available every Sunday, and that's on them. They can come out and make the case and be on TV. So he was there. He was willing to talk. Airtime is not a universal good. There are plenty of candidates who, you know, want to stay away from it because they think it'll hurt their numbers. And it did hurt his numbers. He's got, you know, 60% of the country doesn't think he's fit for the job. His negative is his unfavorable rating.
And did before this current party.
Yeah, and that's right, exactly. he's got terrible numbers that are getting worse with certain groups of the country. So all this coverage is not, you could imagine looking at this, if everybody weren't so in the middle of it, looking at it and saying, boy, the press really set out to ruin this guy by ruining his standing with younger voters, voters of color, college-educated women. Why were they so mean to him by giving him all this airtime? Now, I do think that our job is to be nervous about giving them a platform So you want to give them time to talk. This is purely in the question asking, and then I'll get to to carrying the speeches live. So you want to, what I try and do is, you know, illuminate what are the important questions and then give them a chance to talk. And then, you know, try and hone them down and get them to answer what's really at stake and not their talking points. So there's a balance of letting them talk and then pressing them on what they say. I think when you give, when you carry a speech live, say you say the speech goes for an hour. So then you need an hour of questions about the speech. I think there's a balance.
Oh, that's interesting.
And so if you're not, if you're not doing the balancing thing, then you've left something out of balance. So I think that's where, the people who are in charge of that have to, figure out how to do that rebalancing, or else you're just giving them a platform, an undifferentiated, with no editorial.
I like
platform.
By the way, I'm a huge fan of the Chiron fact check. Huge fan of that. I love that.
Yeah. Although yes, but it's confusing to me. But I think that's an attempt to rebalance. And so that's
anything you're going to try.
Sure. That's an attempt to try and find exactly the kind of balance I was talking about.
I always lie about the last question. This really is the last question. He's going in the tank.
Actually lie about it, or you just come up with one more question?
Oh, that is a painful. I do not have the capacity to differentiate between my, it is my belief.
That you are lying or that you're not?
Now I'm confused.
Go ahead.
This is not my family business. So no, in terms of where he's sitting right now, the Furies really seem to have been unleashed in the last week, right? I mean, this has been, it seems to me as if everybody in one goddamn week was like, holy shit, this guy is a major party nominee. Do you think this is a permanent reset in the way that people are viewing this guy? Do you think in general, and this is more of a pundit question, but from your experience, you did just write a book about all these different campaigns. From your experience, is this permanent damage that has been done in your observation, or do you think that this is a moment in time?
For his campaign. I think it's, I think there's accretion. I think he's taking on barnacles, and that a few barnacles, hurts the hull of a ship, but once the thing is encrusted, then it's not seaworthy. So I think there is a cumulative effect here. And the later there are these episodes, the more it affirms there will be more of them, makes it harder to recalibrate them, in other words, to show the discipline that will expunge the fears about his unpredictability and volatility. And the clock is ticking, so there are fewer days in which were there to be a new disciplined Donald Trump, he could then perform on the stage and compete with Hillary Clinton and do all the work that you have to do to actually get a campaign underway.
Right.
So I think as the clock ticks, this is both greater in actual magnitude, but then also because it's coming later in the process, it has the chance to do more damage. And I have been struck this week, and it may just be because I've been on the phone more, although I've been selling this book all week, so I don't know how exactly I've done that. But in just the number of conversations I've had this week with people who are, as they say on the Hill, voting yes, but hoping no, which is to say they are endorsing him. They cannot get free of their endorsement, but think he's going to lose and think he should lose, that are Republicans, that are party people, officials.
Well, I stole more time.
Even talked about the book, which is the nation.
Shit, man, I'm sorry.
It's totally, you can't imagine the fibrillation you feel in these walls or Americans running to go get the book.
Listen, I don't want to tell you how to market this thing. But here's what we have done. We have used the book as a framing device for the entire discussion. The book has been a leitmotif that has gone through the whole damn thing.
But they tell me, apparently in book selling, leitmotif you can't have. You have to just bash people over
the
head with it.
What is the best thing you got in this book,
Dickerson? No, the best thing is that the stories are just great. You know most of the stories, and the ones you don't know you'll love, but they're just great stories.
Tell me the one story that you think has the most contemporary resonance.
Well, Wallace in 68. I mean, that's you know, because he's comes out of nowhere. People think he's a joke. He finds an anger in the in the electorate, not just in the South, but in the Midwest. He talks about polls all the time. He gets in fight with protesters all the time. And ultimately, in the end, the mechanisms used to defeat him are the ones that the Clinton campaign are using now to try and defeat Trump, both appealing to Midwestern blue-collar voters and saying, look, this guy says he's on your side, but really, when you look at what he does in his own company, in Wallace's case, what he does back in Alabama, it's not on your side. They used Curtis LeMay to basically delegitimize Wallace and say they called him the Bomsey twins because Curtis LeMay's running mate was in favor of mechanic solutions to world problems.
Upon whom General Ripper from Dr. Strangelove was based.
That's right. And who talked about bombing the Vietnamese back into the Stone Age and said other creative and clever things like that. I love the line from Kennedy, which is, if you're going to go, you want Curtis LeMay in the bomber seat, but you don't want Curtis LeMay anywhere around if you're deciding whether you should go or not go.
A guy who said, by the way, during the firebombing of Tokyo, that if we lose this thing, I'm going to go up on war crimes.
Yeah.
One of the great LeMay. So let me ask you about Wallace. Tell me a little bit about the research on Wallace. I love the Frady book.
Right. So the Frady book is a fantastic piece of writing just a thin, beautiful little volume of great kind of old-fashioned news magazine writing. Dan Carter's book about Wallace is really great. It puts things in historical context.
From Dothan, Alabama, Wiregrass.
Newspaper articles of the time are fascinating because you see...
I worked for the Birmingham Post-Herald for 2 years. My first newspaper job was covering George Wallace Death Watch.
So the newspaper articles are great because you see the punditry at the time sort of saying, oh, he's not very serious. And then you see there's a Broder article about Johnson's former head of the census, who then becomes kind of like a pollster for him or a statistician, and who says, you know, what Wallace may be doing in 68 isn't about 68. It's about him running as a Democrat in 72, which he then, of course, went on and did. And won Florida, won every county in Florida. The articles from the time are just great to read too in terms of
the tone.
Max Frankel, is it Max Frankel or Gene Reynolds? I guess it's Gene Reynolds who's writing about the tone, but also just the way they looked at politics. You know,
what do you mean? Just give me a sense.
The way they wrote about candidates is just, I don't know. It seems a little different. They spent more time with the candidates than we do now. And maybe that's because Wallace was flying on a small plane with a small press corps.
And was a charmer, by the way.
Kind of, in a funny way. I mean, because some of the things he said weren't that charming. So, right. But was a magnetic personality.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And I guess some of that comes through in the coverage of it.
You can hear it on the tape if you ever hear like it's the Kennedy and Katzenbach tapes during the desegregation in Tuscaloosa. You can hear the real Wallace.
Yes. Yeah. Another, the Kennedy Katzenbach, you're talking about Robert Kennedy Katzenbach. That's the filming of that is another Robert Drew. Isn't that a Robert Drew film?
With the kids running around his office?
Yeah.
Ugh.
The other thing is the coverage of some of the lines about the Wallace supporters in California where he first got on the ballot, that kind of just conspiracy theories. That feel super modern. The idea that the Rockefellers were going to come kind of imprison everyone and that you needed to be armed to fight back against the Rockefellers. Just that sort of sense of, obviously nobody's worried about the Rockefellers anymore, but you hear a little of that in some of the voters you might talk to out on the trail. And that was always, that's the greatest thing about it. And the only way I could write about 19 different presidential races going all the way back to 1800 is that it's all on PDF now. I didn't have to go into a library and
you actually went and sat around and did this stuff.
There's a PhD student who's now a proper historian who, when I was working on it for the podcast, would send me mountains and mountains of clippings in PDF form. So, and then I would read them on my iPad.
And you just imbibe this stuff. You just dig it.
I dig it because usually... You can read one article and say, oh, that's not that interesting. But when you read about the 1940 Republican Convention and the what they called the mics, which was short for microphone, which was a new word they were using in 1940 because it's the first time that they were writing about television coverage. That's just fun on its face. But then you see echoes of you know, so in, I was writing about 1940 because Wendell Willkie, obviously a businessman who comes in.
One of the great voices in politics. If you haven't heard an audio recording of Willkie, he sounds like a frog.
That's true. You know, Wendell Willkie, who was a Democrat like a year before he became the Republican nominee and whose parents were both Germans.
Right.
Now, think about that. If you had, I mean, by the time the Republican convention's happening, you know, Hitler is in, he's in France.
Yeah.
I mean, everybody knows what a problem Hitler and the Germans are, and yet they nominate a person of German descent. And, you know, in today's politics, you can't imagine a Muslim American being nominated as the nominee of the Republican Party. Anyway, it's a...
Well, the Wallace stuff, I agree with you on the Wallace stuff. I think the Wallace stuff is really fascinating. And I think people misinterpret. One of the things is, and I will let you go now since we talked about the book, but one of the things I think is really interesting about the interpretation, particularly Obama supporters have and Clinton supporters have of the Trump supporters, is they really think it's entirely racial. The thing about Wallace is, not to get too deeply in the weeds on this stuff, there was a lot of a lot of this stuff is also class.
Sure, absolutely.
And in Birmingham, particularly, you know, that's in Sweet Home Alabama, they say in Birmingham they love the governor. Birmingham never voted for Wallace, ever. They always voted for, they love Folsom. They love the other guys, didn't like Wallace. But there was a lot of labor competition going on at that particular point in time. So last question is, and this is
The point you make is a super important one, which is on the Wallace bus, and this is true, very, very true of the, more true, I don't know. Anyway, on the bus, there are different kinds of supporters. And so somebody in the first row may be voting for, you know, Wallace because purely on race, purely segregationist. But the person in the fifth row is just worried about crime in the cities. And they, you know, there may not be a racial element to that. They may just be worried.
Most of the time, it's, as you know, getting back to your point about talking with people, it sloshes together.
Sure, of course. Of
course. We don't have any single...
Yeah.
We don't as do you have a single
motivations
motivation for
aren't
anything
that clean.
That you
yeah.
do?
No, that's exactly right. Yeah. Although it's somebody in the fifth row would be shocked and find repugnant what's being said in the first row, but they can still support the same person and not have to come to terms with the different levels of motivation. And I think so for example, I don't think it does anybody any good to define the Trump movement by the craziest thing somebody yells at a Trump rally, just as it's no good to define the marchers at a Black Lives Matter march by the ones who are yelling, you know, if somebody yells, kill the police. I think that that's one of our problems in politics right now, is that both sides try and encourage a definition of the other by the craziest adherent to the
and social media
candidate,
accentuates that. So, okay, here's a dismount. What did you learn from the Wallace experience that is either predictive or explanatory of the Trump thing?
Well, one thing, I guess it's, I don't know if it's explanatory. I think the desire to correct both in the press and the politicians when they think a politician has discovered something that they were missing, which in Wallace's case is the same with Trump, which was they're missing the anger in the electorate. I don't think we missed the anger. Anybody who covered the Tea Party movement or Pat Buchanan in 1992 knew that there were angry voters out there. I think it's a surprise that Trump would be the tribune of those voters. And I think that maybe we should have seen that coming in a way. But on the other, you know, we don't need to go down that road. Yeah. But I think there was the same thing with Wallace, that there was a lot of surprise and then a kind of overreading of his candidacy. I think there are tactically there's those interesting parallels that are the same that are being used to try and that were used to dismount Wallace that are trying to be used to get rid of or to try and hurt Trump. And then I think the other is just the power of those appeals that appeal to grievance and abandonment by your government that you put this hope in and the. You know, everybody attacks elites. I mean, I remember when Bob Dole used to talk about Boutros Ghali at the United Nations, and that was, he'd get a huge roaring. Yep. You know, the idea that distant elites are making decisions for you. But Wallace and Trump have that, know how to work that better than other politicians. And just so that parallel is the same. I get what interests me a lot of times is the difference, though. In 68, you had busing and housing policies that were really reaching into people's lives in a way that's a little bit different now. In 68, you had Wallace's poll numbers rise with the death of Kennedy and then Martin Luther King and then the 68 convention. We don't have violence
like that
now.
Which people don't realize that. That's right.
You know, we don't have violence like that now. So
what we do have, though, is the end of a familiar pattern of power. You have women and you have an African-American president on the mm-hmm. ascent. And I think people who are not of those groups or are not allied with those groups have a perception that the world that they signed up for is no longer existing.
Right. And but I think in the same way that elites think that a world of diversity and changing values is wonderful and neat and that's part of progress, I think that's exactly what Wallace was running against, right. Which is this isn't good. This is leading to a lot of bad outcomes and cultural change, and we got these hippies marching, and that weakness of the hippies marching is what's leading to the weakness in Vietnam, and the cultural and the riots in the cities represent a weakness in kind of, you know, well, in law and order, which he used even before Nixon did. But the last thing I would say is that there's more calling out of Donald Trump than there was of Wallace, because
that's good.
Nixon didn't call Wallace out the way Paul Ryan calls out Donald Trump. And Paul Ryan supports him, I mean, which is another complexity. But I think you can't, Wallace could get away. And Nixon, you know, he flirted with and told delegates at the 68 convention in private meetings, you know, I'm not going to be overturning the Civil Rights Act, but I'm not going to be, you know, I'm not going to be some crazy civil rights president.
Well, he was, of course, reacting. By the way, what people don't realize about Wallace is the great George Wallace quote is the I won't be out-end.
Mm-hmm. Well, after he lost his
race
for governor.
And he was afloat on forces that he himself necessarily did not control.
Yeah, that's right.
So anyway, this has been a really enjoyable 4.5-hour conversation.
Exactly. Time for breakfast. <Yeah. laughs>